the mighty Mississippi blowing a breeze through the line of stately 100-year-old trees. The uninvited guests certainly made for lively dinner conversation at the reception in the main hall. By the time the servers made their fourth round with bottles of imported champagne, several men, including prim little Father Halliwell, were lining up to have their pictures taken with the Viper before somebody from parish services finally came to haul the carcass away. Still, she took it as a sign. A reminder, really, that Bellevue, its beauty, was not to be trusted. That beneath its loamy topsoil, the manicured grounds and gardens, 2 centuries of breathtaking wealth and spectacle, lay a land both black and bitter, soft to the touch, but pressing in its power. She should have known that one day it would spit out what it no longer had use for, the secrets it would no longer keep. The plantation proper sat on 18 acres, bordered to the north by the river and to the east by the raw, unincorporated landscape of Ascension Parish. To walk it, from the library in the northwest corner to the gift shop and then over to the main house, past the stone kitchen and the rose garden, the cottages Manette and Leroy, the old schoolhouse and the quarters, took nearly an hour. Karen had learned to start her days early, while it was quiet, heading out before sunlight, having arranged for Letty to arrive by 6 a.m. at least 3 days a week, while Karen's daughter was sleeping. 6 mornings out of 7, she made a full sweep of the property, combing every square inch, noting any scuffed floors or dry flower beds or drapes that needed to be steamed, even one time changing the motor in one of the gallery ceiling fans herself. She didn't mind the work. Bellevue was her job, and she was nothing if not professional, though she could in no way have prepared herself for the grisly sight before her now. To the south and west, across a nearly 5-foot-high fence where Karen was standing, the back 500 acres of the Clancy family's 157-year-old property had been leased for cane farming since before she was born. Over the fence line, puffs of gray smoke shot up out of the fields. The machines were out in the cane this morning, already on the clock. The mechanical cutters were big and wide as tractor trucks, fat, gassy beasts whose engines often disturbed the natural habitat, chasing rats and snakes and rabbits from their nests in the cane fields. And come harvest time each year, the animals invariably sought out a safe and peaceful living on the grounds of Bellevue. Louise had run them out of the garden, cleared their fecal waste from his tool shed, and, on more than one occasion, trapped and bagged a specimen to take home for God knows what purpose. And now some critter had dug up the dirt and grass along the plantation's fence line and come up with this. The body was face down. In a makeshift grave so shallow that its walls hugged the corpse as snugly as a shell, as if the dead woman at Karen's feet were on the verge of hatching, of emerging from her confinement to start this life over again. She was coated with mud, top to bottom, her arms and legs tucked beneath her body, the spine in a curved position. The word fetal came to mind. Karen thought, for a brief, dizzying second, that she might faint. "Don't touch her," she said. "Don't touch a thing." She'd been up since dawn that cold Thursday morning. It was a day that had already gotten off to a wrong start before she'd even stepped foot out of the house, though for an entirely different reason. She'd woken up that morning to a message on her cell phone, one that had set off a minor staff crisis. Donovan Isaacs had the nerve to call in sick for the 3rd time in 2 weeks, this time leaving a nearly incoherent voicemail message on her phone at 4 o'clock in the morning and keeping Karen in her pajamas for over an hour as she sent emails and placed phone calls, searching for a replacement. She didn't know if it was because she was a woman or black, a sister, as he would say, but she'd never had an employee make so little effort to impress her. He was chronically late and impossible to get on the phone, responding sporadically to text messages or nagging calls to his grandmother, with whom he lived while taking classes at the River Valley Community College and working here part-time. His salary, like those of the other Bellevue players, was paid by a yearly stipend from the state's Department of Culture, Recreation, and Tourism, which made firing him a bureaucratic headache, but one she was no less committed to pursuing.